Sarah Cooper, date July 25th, 2002, interview number 2. Interview takes place at the house of Carol King on 60 El Circulo in Pasadena, 91105. Testing, testing. Can you hear this? Testing. So some follow-up questions from last time. First of all, I was wondering about some of the housing, some details of the chronology of where you lived. While you were at USC, you lived in Eagle Rock, you told me last time, for the most part,
yes.
Right? And then you worked for Jim Logan, and you lived in the
Hollywood
Hills.
Well, I didn't really work for Jim Logan.
Okay.
He was building spec houses in Hollywood Hills, and somehow I met him and talking with him, and I moved into one of them and finished it, and then he built another one, and it was really a funny period in my life that happened, and then that lasted about a year or something, I guess.
Okay. And then I know that you lived in a bunch of places, the Schindler House, Beverly Glen with your wife, Domus Solaris, Domus Dos. Is that about the right order?
Yeah.
Okay.
Domus Solaris first.
Domus Solaris was before what?
Before Domus Dos.
Oh, of course. That makes sense, doesn't it? And the Schindler House, I wanted to know just a little bit more about what it was like to live there. You said that you got in there because you had a friend who was living there?
Yeah, and I was kind of in between houses or jobs, and there was one unit available, and it was kind of exciting, the fact of having a space there. It was a hillside overlooking the lake, and very disjointed, but exciting because a great view. But the stairs are very steep, and some of the rooms are quite small. And it was typically Schindler-esque, but it was fun and exciting, and not in really great shape. It was all right. I think I mentioned on Fernwood, not far from there,
right.
Little house on Fernwood, and that was kind of a speculator house. And sold that, moved to a house for a very short period of time in the Hollywood Hills, which was the temporary thing, just a few months, hardly even worth noting.
Okay.
And then started on doing Domus Solaris.
Great.
That was my the ultimate
bachelor pad, right? I remember. At the Schindler House, did that inspire you with your own architecture at all?
Not really.
No, it was just sort of a place.
It was not what you call a great Schindler. It was just kind of exciting because of being on a hillside overlooking the lake and being in a house with a lot of glass and that sort of thing. So.
Did people come to visit the house while you were there at all?
But I didn't entertain it much. I was working very hard at that time, and not too much time for entertaining. So,
okay.
But I had a social life, and it wasn't that long a period.
Okay, a couple more questions just to follow up. Did you ever meet Neutra? Because I know he was around. He died in 1970.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. As I think I told you, my business partner's father came over in the old country with Richard Neutra.
Right.
And he played with Dion, and I only really saw Neutra when he lectured down at USC. He'd come there and speak to the students in the auditorium. And it was always kind of a big deal because they'd usually get a packed auditorium, and then he would wait, the lights go off, and then they'd open up the door and he'd come in and parade down. You know, I always tried to be very elegant about it.
Oh yeah?
He was trying very hard to be, the great man. And I looked up to him. He did some very fine homes and, one of the better architects.
Sure,
every time we'd find out that the new Neutra house was going up, we'd visit it and kind of watch it during construction. So he made an impression we didn't plagiarize, of course, but we were impressed with his work.
Which aspects of it were you particularly impressed by?
Well, the cleanliness and the simplicity.
Huh.
And the use of large areas of glass and just use of planes and Basically, I guess like the Kaufman House in Palm Springs was one of the more notable ones. And we had a lot of respect for him. And then he had a technique, and about the only one thing that we really did borrow from him. He was one of the very few, if not the only architect that supplemented working drawings with a little blue book, which I'd call it the Bible.
Huh.
It was a handbook that had all of the details in it, and interior elevations, and as opposed to having those on one great big sheet, he had this book that contained specifications, interior elevations, details, and all that. And so we were one of the other very few architects that used that technique.
Huh.
So we would supplement our working drawings, to which we did a lot of working drawings, and have it with a little black book.
Were you inspired by him to do that, or had you done
that
before?
Well, he was the only one that did it. We thought it was a good technique.
Yeah.
We were very unusual in the fact that we did complete details of everything.
Yes.
We didn't believe that you could eliminate certain window or door details or anything that was significant. And instead of drawing all the little details on a great big sheet, we thought it made a lot of sense to do them in small sheets. And some of them we could use in other jobs.
Oh, that makes sense.
So we could supplement, especially in the we thought that would be the case. However, it turned out that we didn't really repeat the same thing over and over again as much as we thought we would.
Huh.
So we had almost every job was a little different, and we'd do different details, but that's the way we worked.
Just because you got inspired differently each time?
Yeah, did different mood, different materials, different client, different details. It seemed to work for a while, but like every job is a new job.
Sure.
But we kept that until we had a little complication. The building department put a kibosh on it because they didn't like that. They liked big rolls of drawings, and we would submit them. The engineer also did his details on them. So the building department didn't like that. The roll of drawings with the big book. Rubber band to it. It was very cumbersome for them. And then one thing we did find out about that technique is as we were building the houses ourselves, which I told you about, if a general contractor or a sub didn't like the technique, we didn't like the sub because it pinned them down too much. There's so much detail, they wanted to have more flexibility. So we knew that if they were not interested in that they were not the people for us.
The ones that
enjoyed it, thought it was great. We liked them because they would like details and they knew how to put things together. That was very important.
So you probably found a lot of really good people that way, people who were willing to pay
attention. Yeah, we found a younger group that were willing to, that wanted to learn and be involved and do the things the right way and not just do standard, you know, house buildings.
Right.
So there's a big difference, and mostly you've got younger carpenters that were interested in doing the framing, and most of us involved in the framing and some of the concrete, and almost inevitably once they, one or two younger carpenters got involved, and then they would eventually get into being general contractors. We never kept them for a very long period of time. They would do framing, and then they get into more and more of the architecture, more and more of the contracting part, and next thing we knew they were general contractors. So it was a kind of evolution, and we trained a lot of young carpenters that way.
Huh. So, did a lot of other architects train people like that?
No, it was very rare. We were one of the very few that did that.
Huh.
Very few if any of the architects acted as agent of owner.
Right.
And built the structure they designed, which I think I meant before.
Yes.
I told you about
yes,
before.
You did. Huh. Do you feel like that added to your architecture to train those other people?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
How so?
Well, you, by being involved in the contracting part of it, you knew how things go together, but you also know what things cost. Because we were involved in doing all of the cost breakdowns and overseeing construction and scheduling the job. So it was all the things that a general contractor did, but we were doing them, and as a result we became more educated. Mm-hmm. How buildings go together, and it was just kind of a natural evolution. you learn by doing. Mm-hmm. As I told you, the first one we did is in La Cañada in 52.
Right.
And we found it interesting, and also the big advantage was it supplemented our income. So when things got a little slow, which they always do, ups and down, and of the architectural business, and we could fall back on the contracting part of it to supplement our income.
Go ahead.
And then we, if business got really busy, we just hire more draftsmen. If they slacked off, then we'd fall back on building.
Did you find that knowing all of these contractors helped build you a network?
Oh yeah.
Of people larger than
absolutely.
Many other architects?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. And we'd find, we'd get a variety of bids on every sub, but sometimes we would find a man, like a tile man, was particularly good. That we, it was always, the price was right, and the work, quality of the work was always good, and we didn't see any great benefit of getting any other bids, because we knew that we had a good man. Mm-hmm. Even though he might be a little higher, we knew the quality would be there. Mm. And our biggest changes were in the framing contractors. And each job is unique. It's one of the unusual things where you bid it out, and sometimes the steel contractor would be, we'd get various bids on steel, one would be higher than the other one. The next job, the higher one would be lower than the next one.
Really?
So, yeah, it's very inconsistent.
Huh.
So it gave us a good picture of how things go.
Sure. Wow. I had another question about architect. You obviously mentioned that Frank Lloyd Wright was a big influence on your work. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Sure. It was a great... when I was a student at SC, School of Architecture, it was traditional when you were in the second year design at Easter vacation, you go to Taliesin. It's like going to Mecca or some great big trip that you do. Trying to Guadalupe or whatever it might be, but so the more in students always knew about that, and so Buff and I and a couple other students jumped in his VW bus and of course took off for Taliesin, and it was a very memorable experience because Conrad had borrowed his father's large view camera, which is in a big box.
Couple of feet wide.
Oh yeah. And so we're all very excited to get to Taliesin. I don't know if you're familiar with Taliesin.
Sure, I've seen pictures. I haven't been there.
So, you know, that time is back in 1948, you know. And they were still, students were still building some of the big stone walls, and there was activity going all over the place. But it was probably 95% complete and very exciting. And it was a beautiful afternoon, or noonish. Conrad gets out. He puts the tripod up in the middle of the courtyard, and he puts the camera on top of the tripod and starts to put the cable over his head, and the voice comes out of the somewhere and says, "My dear boys, what are you doing?" And Conrad looks around. He doesn't see anyone, but he looks up on the balcony up above, and there is Frank Lloyd Wright. And Conrad very shakenly said, "We are students from the School of Architecture, University of Southern California." And Wright said, "And does that make you God?" And of course, Conrad and Tony, and I'll never forget too, Wright said, "Were you heralded here?" And he says, "My dear boy, you put that camera away and you'll be informed when you can photograph." So Conrad very clumsily put everything back, and about an hour later, one of the draftsmen came by, and we had our own little group, and he said, "Mr. Wright said you can photograph now. And if you so desire, he'll meet you in the theater around 5 o'clock. So, of course, at 5, 10 minutes to 5, we were in the theater, and another couple of, maybe 6 or 8 other tourists or students were there, and Wright came out and sat on the edge of the stage and talked to us for about an hour.
What did he say?
Oh, I wish I could remember. I wish I had recorded, but that was 50 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We just talked about architecture, and he probably just philosophized and told some of his experience. I just really have no recollection there. You're always kind of in awe.
How did he strike you as a person when you saw him speak?
Oh, well, you're kind of mesmerized, as you might imagine, being a lowly second year student, and here's Wright, the greatest architect in the world, and he's sitting there talking to you, mano a mano, so man to man. So,
did he seem, he has a reputation for being somewhat abrupt.
Oh yeah, well he's somewhat arrogant and snobbish and quite a superiority complex, but he probably deserves it, you know. But we expected it. Mm-hmm. We knew enough about him. So I was talking man to man, you couldn't hardly put him down for that.
No.
Very nice, he came out and gave the time to us.
Oh yeah. Did you expect to be able to see him when you went to Taliesin?
Oh, we had no idea.
Huh.
Of course, we were kind of hopeful. We didn't know. We just wanted to see Taliesin. We didn't expect to see Ryder. And then we got a great tour with him, not by him, but through the whole place. It was extremely exciting at that time.
Oh yeah.
When he was in charge, and I don't know if you were aware of it, but he wanted all of the people there that under his tutelage to be talented in all the arts. So students wrote plays, they performed music, they had black tie dinners occasionally, they had people that cooked, they had people that served, and then they interchanged all these sort of things. And they had to have proper table manners. So when you became professional, you were aware of all those sort of things, which is pretty good.
Oh yeah.
So you knew which side the fork was on and how to cut a piece of meat. And if you couldn't sing soprano, that's too bad, but you do something else, play a flute or play the piano.
Huh.
So good in that respect. So a lot of respect, and really admired him, and of course always admired his work.
Oh sure. Do you remember taking the tour of Taliesin? What do you remember most about that tour?
I remember most is the master bedroom in the fireplace in the master bedroom, which was, and I think it's very rare that you got into that, whether Wright took us in or not, I can't remember. But the not only a great Wrightian bedroom, but the giant fireplace, one whole wall was a fireplace with anirons cantilevered out from the wall and giant logs on it, 4 or 5 feet long. And the whole hearth was a reflection pool, as opposed to a stone hearth. So if you can imagine with the roaring fire going and all the embers falling into the water and water moving and acting as a mirror, so the whole room would just be, always wanted to do something like that, but of course you've got to have a bunch of 16 servants to clean the reflection pool every morning and bring in the logs and all that sort of thing. Is completely, impractical as hell. But never have done that yet. Never, maybe someday. But that's what I remember most of all. Plus the whole place is so intriguing and so unique and so inviting and it's just wonderful spaces, shades and shadows and all that sort of thing. Middle of the desert.
Oh yeah. Was it just the couple of you who were listening to Frank Lloyd Wright? How many students were there?
There must have been 10. I'm not sure they're all students. There were 4 of us.
Okay.
And keeping us seated. I don't think there were any other students from SC at that time. But there was, I remember, half a dozen other people. So we all just sit around and very casually talking to Wright.
Wow.
But other than that, I don't remember any specific things he said other than, does that make you God and were you heralded here?
That's good enough.
Yeah,
gosh.
Yeah.
When you went back to USC, did you sense that you were changed at all by the experience?
No. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. You don't feel those things. You have memories, but it doesn't affect you any materially.
Huh. Did you run into Wright later in his life before he died in 59?
I think he did lecture at SC. Once again, I saw him there, but you don't go up to him and say, remember, shake his hand and buy him a drink. You don't do that.
Right. That's great. Anything else you want to say about Wright before we go on?
No, just I still admire him a lot.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to talk about the bulk of your career, because we really haven't gotten into much of that yet. I was wondering, first of all, when did you set up your practice in Pasadena? Was it, because you were on the west side for a while, right?
Well, when Conrad and I first became partners, we took over his father's studio. I don't know if I told you that.
In Eagle Rock.
In Eagle Rock.
Right.
And then we took on, we were getting a little busier, and in that we were teaching at SC, we took on two of the better students as draftsmen, and then we really felt we needed to expand. We were pretty tight quarters because now we're starting to be drafting group of draftsmen. Conrad and Igorok, we just had one long board about 16 feet long. We both worked, we had drawing parallel rules there. So we, did I tell you about 7th Street?
You mentioned it very quickly.
Yeah, we moved down to, because we were teaching, one of our clients, El Bea, who we did a house for in Pasadena, up in Glen Oaks, wanted to take an office on 7th Street. So we shared an office with him, and we had a drafting room with south exposure, which was really miserable on a day like today. We had no air conditioning, and we were drawing without shirts and perspiring. It was just horrible. And then we got involved with Straub, and he shared that office with us. We had some drafting tables around the perimeter of the wall and a big island in the middle. And then we took another office down further west on 7th Street. It was kind of a Spanish colonial office building with a courtyard.
Where was it? What was that, the cross street?
That was around Alva. I don't remember the cross street now, but it's a little west, about 4 blocks west of Alvarado.
Okay.
Very nice. No, it's still on 7th Street. And there we did quite a bit of work there. We were there for 2 or 3 years. We expanded a little bit and took over some of the other offices. And then I think that's when Cal left during that time. And then Conrad and I went back to Eagle Rock, but then we knew we couldn't work in that space, so we took on Dick Fleming and Chuck McCune, and then we started looking for other drafting space.
Are those two people the original draftsmen whom you hired from USC?
We had a lot of different students working for us, depending on how busy we were.
Okay.
But they were the two primary ones. We decided to take them on as associates, and so we looked and we found an office space on La Cienega in Santa Monica.
Oh.
That was office of Ken Lind, who had done a lot of commercial work, a lot of big apartment buildings, that sort of thing, on the west side of town. But he had kind of retired, and he was looking for someone to take over that office. It had 6 drafting boards in it and a reception place, and then had an office on the side that he could keep for himself if he could come there during the day and just kind of rest. So we had agreement too that if he got some commissions after he retired, that we could work out a deal where we could take over some of his jobs that he couldn't take on. And that worked out very nicely. During that time, Dick Fleming's had some marital problems and with his kids and all, and he had to leave the firm and move back with his family.
Oh.
And then Chuck McCune took on a kind of a different partnership, so Conrad and I never took them on as full partners. They were just kind of associates. But then we were hiring different draftsmen. And luckily, teaching as we did, we knew some of the prime students there and the graduates, and we always had access to good men. Hmm.
So this was the mid-50s when you were moving around all these offices, approximately?
Later, because we were there in La Cienega late 60s, 70s.
Oh, that late?
Oh, yeah.
When did you stop teaching at USC?
About 62.
Right, okay.
63.
Right.
And then we were still up in 7th Street and then back, and then we moved out to... So I don't remember how long we were in La Cienega, but I think we got... We started feeling we didn't want to pay the rent. We wanted to do our own building.
Uh-huh.
So we started looking for property, and we found some on Cahuenga, which is quite nice. We did a lot of cost analysis in that. But we were good friends with John Carr, who's one of the top realtors in Pasadena. And in fact, Carr was the big realtor. His father and John had taken over. And he just by coincidence met Conrad, and they said there's a site for sale there by Crossman Annandale Golf Course, 1450 West Colorado, and we jumped in that. And we bought it, or we made arrangements to buy it. And so we designed the office there, this got to be 20 years ago, sometime around 1980.
Oh, so that late you moved to Pasadena?
Yeah.
Huh.
Maybe a little earlier, maybe 78, but late 70s or early 80s. And that's about, well, we did the King House here in 79, so we were there, so it was probably a little before that.
Okay.
And yeah, this is 23 years old, and we did the King House from here.
Right, so
but
maybe
John wrote it down, so it's probably maybe 75, 76, okay. I guess.
Had you been designing it? You'd been designing some in Pasadena before that,
though.
All over the area.
Most of our houses were in Pasadena.
Yeah.
We started out with, in fact, before Cal Straw was a partner, we were just out of school. I think our first was the first Merriman number one on Orange Grove, and then some other houses up in the hills here and all over Pasadena. We were doing houses.
Why did you start? Why did you have so many commissions in Pasadena?
Conrad was living here.
Uh-huh.
And. Of course, I was living in Eagle Rock, which
right.
was by, and we had mutual friends and contacts and that sort of thing. And you never, it's hard to remember. We did the house in Arrowhead while we were still students because that was for his parents.
Right.
And then we did the house for my aunt and uncle, as I told you, in Burbank, his aunt and uncle. And then one for Dr. Fisher in La Cañada because I was the Buff's dentist. The senior Buff's dentist.
Yes.
And he'd like to help younger people, so we got that job. All these things, memories kind of come back as you think about them.
But sure.
They're all important, but you don't think about them every day. But evolution and how things, one thing leads to another.
Did the area appeal to you? Did you ever think, I want to design in the San Gabriel Valley, or did it just sort of happen?
We were very flexible. We were willing to go any place, Malibu, Palm Springs, Beverly Hills.
Right. You did.
Making a difference to us, it was just nice that we had kind of a home base here in the Pasadena area.
Sure.
Very important. Yeah, we loved Pasadena very much, and great sights for the hillsides and the Norton Simon Museum, and just a great area to be.
Sure. What about the museum? Just that it's this world-class cultural center?
Well, we knew it because Thornton Ladd, who designed it, was a classmate.
That's right. That's right.
And we thought it was a nice building, all things considered.
Yeah.
And we knew the home he had designed for his mother up in San Rafael, which is a very nice job. And also, being a classmate of Thornton's, I did a project with him up in the studio, that particular site, and great big glass studio overlooking Pasadena. So, it was impressive.
Where was that exactly?
His studio was adjacent to his mother's home that Ladd did. I worked on a big group project with Thornton up there. It was above the bridges, looking down over the bridges and looking back into Pasadena.
Okay, do you remember what street that was on?
San Rafael.
San Rafael, okay. Let me stop.